we can get to Anchorage. We went to Fairbanks at one time, but the money has not been liberal, to say the least, and so we have worked within certain limitations.
Well, if you can, at least communicate to your lobbyist here in Juneau, who is a member of the bar and a former attorney general. I'm sure he could be present at some of our markup and communicate your comments as we get to individual sections.
Thank you for allowing us to present our views.
Thank you, Mr. Bryce. Mr. Snowden?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Art Snowden, Administrative Director of the Alaska Court System. I've been asked here today to express any views that the judiciary as a third branch of government might have on the criminal code, and after discussions with the Supreme Court, our statement is very short, that the judiciary has supported and for a long time the concept of a criminal code. We do believe that issue to be an important one to this state, and for that reason that the judiciary does support that concept. Our posture on substantive issues, however, has not changed. The judiciary will not take any stand on any substantive issues in the code, obviously for the many reasons that many of those provisions may be litigated before the courts of the state, and as you well know, that the judiciary does not take stands on substantive issues of law that are before the legislature, and we will not in this case. On administrative impact, we are currently assessing what impact this code or any other code would place upon the judiciary. I think we foresee that any criminal code will place an immediate impact on the judiciary of the state, because there will be much litigation over the wording of various sections of the code, and thus there will be a primary impact at the appeals level for a period of time until that code is annotated over time. That would be expected under any criminal code that passed, and we certainly understand that. I have no further comments to make to this committee unless there are any specific questions you'd like to ask.
Mr. Carpenter.
Mr. Snowden, does that extend also to the sentencing provisions? The court doesn't want to say anything?
As you know, the court and the Judicial Council have supported presumptive sentencing, but once again, we do not take any position on the numbers in that bill, which are the substantive issues. But as a concept, the judiciary has supported presumptive sentencing. Does that fully answer that question?
Not entirely. Apparently, presumptive sentencing means something different to each person who uses the phrase.
I view presumptive sentencing to be that concept put forth by the Judicial Council, working with the Department of Law, the Public Defender, and other public and private agencies in the state, that which concept is embodied in this code. I believe what gets sticky about that issue are the numbers that you come up with in the final analysis, and on those numbers we take no position. But the idea of having a presumptive sentence where you would aggravate and add up to a certain percentage, or in mitigation allowed to deduct certain percentages, is not a concept that is alien to the judiciary of the state.
Mr.
Snowden, without getting into the numbers, the mechanics vary in the different proposals. For example, in the tentative draft, it shows a presumptive sentence that could run from X years to X years, and then it has another category over on this side, which is for mitigating X years to X years, another category over here for aggravating, which goes from X years to X years. Now, when we say presumptive sentencing, does the judiciary like the idea of having those three categories, or would it just have one category from X to X? That kind of thing. You don't have to get into the numbers to discuss that.
I really have not, to be honest with you, Representative Carpenter, discussed that in detail with the Supreme Court. The only thing that we have discussed in any detail was the concept of presumptive sentencing, which the code embodies in a fashion that seems reasonable in its concept. Some states have gone by judicial guidelines rather than presumptive sentencing. There are three or four different things that have happened in this country. Some states have gone to direct determinate sentencing, and we know what that is. Other states, but through legislative fiat, have imposed a type of presumptive sentencing on the judiciaries of those states. A third group of states have, instead of a code-embodied presumptive sentencing, have adopted judicial guidelines for sentencing, which is basically judicially imposed guidelines along those same lines. This state has taken a different posture, and it seems to be more of a union between the legislature and the courts and the councils, which is a more cooperative effort to come up with approximately the same end product. I can go no further in my brief than to say that the judiciary as an institution is not objecting to presumptive sentencing as a concept.
I just close to the observation that I think that the concept of separation of branches is being applied to excess here.
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chairman, to partially rehabilitate the witness, may I assume that most of your comments about presumptive sentencing have been based on the work that was being done last session?
All of my comments on presumptive sentencing are based upon that work, but that presumptive sentencing bill could change as this
see, the
code moves forward through two houses of the legislature, and all that I am prepared to comment on is the issue of presumptive sentencing.
Well, of course, the thing that was, I think, behind the other members' comments and many things we've been talking about other people with sentencing is that the House Judiciary Committee, at least, met with some surprise the sentencing provisions in the code. And they are not, in the view of some of us, really, in any way, really presumptive sentencing. It looks, what the subcommission came up with is substantially, in the view of many of us, different from House Bill 297, which was the work done by the Judicial Council, which the court did authorize you to comment on last year. So I presume from your comments that your comments as they stand relate to a structure like 297.
Exactly. I mean, that is why I would have to get into the specific detail of the changes that have been incorporated in this bill, and I'm not prepared to do that. I don't believe that the judiciary should take a stand on that type of thing. I think that's within the legislative control. You know what was submitted in 297. You know that we worked with the Judicial Council and the Attorney General and Public Defender and many other people in that area, and that the Chief Justice specifically stated in his last State of the Judiciary that we supported that concept. I reiterate, we support the concept of presumptive sentencing, and I really do not believe that that is an overly protective device, Representative Carpenter, in insulating the three branches of government. My feeling is that there are other bills that you would not want us to comment on substantively, as you might want us to comment on this one substantively, and we won't get into those areas either. I don't believe that is the role of the judicial branch of government.
Mr. Chairman, I might agree with the witness in that one area, and I'm he's relieved. He's not accustomed to my ever agreeing with him. And that is that if they were to take a position on a particular section and make the kind of intense comments like we've had from and detail like we've had from the Department of Law or the Bar Association of the Police Chiefs, then what happens if they made a very strong position that you should do this and not do that with regard to a particular section because this ought to be good public policy? Then we go contrary to their view, and then they're presented with having to decide the first case of the same section of litigation. I think that was what Mr. Snowden was talking about, and not a separation of powers argument. And at least if that, to that limited extent, I agree with it. There's anything beyond that, I don't.
Is there any more questions for the witness?
Well, other than just to clarify, Mr. Chairman, that is 297 that Chief Justice Boutier spoke on in public last year and used that as a circumstance of one which the court thought was a good.
And as I said, I have tried and represented pretrial on numerous defendants in federal court that have been charged with conspiracy. I submit that that Mr. Bryson's comments are correct, and that the comments of that commentator are correct, that it's really unnecessary to have a conspiracy statute here in Alaska. And what you're doing is opening up the potential for abuse through a needless prosecution, and also a number of fairly esoteric and complicated evidentiary problems. Now, turning to this, the specific statute for a moment, which appears at page 14 of the bill, there's been some talk about this being a limited conspiracy statute. Well, it is perhaps limited if you compare it to some other conspiracy statutes, but it's not limited in the sense of its potentials for abuse. And specifically, the statute provides that a person commits the crime of conspiracy if, with intent to promote or facilitate conduct constituting murder, arson in the first degree, kidnapping in any degree, extortion, or schemes to defraud in the first degree, he enters with one or more persons to engage in or cause the performance of that conduct. And he or one of those persons does an overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy. If we turn for a moment to the definition of extortion, I think you'll see how broad this statute really is. And excuse me just for a moment, gentlemen.
Extortion would be, I believe, 1146.
What page would that be, Mr. Stern?
One second. 58, I believe.
Yeah, yes, 58.
And you need the definition of.
Yes, that's what I was coming to in a moment. First, we read the definition of extortion. A person commits a crime of extortion if, with intent to deprive another of property or to appropriate property of another, he attains property of another by threat. Then we must also turn to the definition of threat, and that's in
page
136 of your bill. And this is where it really gets very broad. The reason I think you'll realize this is broad is because of subparagraph 9 VII. This is a threat that can constitute extortion. To use or abuse one's position as a public servant by performing some act within or related to another's official duties, or by failing or refusing to perform an official duty in such a manner as to affect some person adversely. I submit, gentlemen, that if you draft this present conspiracy statute as drafted, would open the door to indictments for numerous allegations of extortion. I think you're all familiar with the recent publicity surrounding, for instance, the ABM proposals in Anchorage with the TV stations and the allegations in the press that they were extorting people because they were threatening to go to the federal people in Washington and get their license revoked if they didn't give them money. It's not a very big step from those allegations in the press to an indictment if someone at that particular time decides that it's politically feasible or appropriate to indict someone for that. I just read one paragraph, but the concept of threat includes accuse a person of a crime or cause criminal charges to be instituted against a person, expose a secret or publicize an asserted fact, whether true or false, tending to subject a person to hatred, contempt, or ridicule, or to impair his credit or business repute. The reason this is such an area of concern is that it's often easy for lawyers to know when it's proper to make statements that you're going to go to a police officer, that you're going to sue, that you're not going to sue. But often laypersons do not understand the fine distinctions between civil compromise and under the statute, threats that would constitute extortion. And I think you're really opening the door to a lot of needless indictments. And then I haven't examined in detail the fraud in the first degree statutes, but I submit again that knowing the eccentricities of business transactions, that again, this may be a decision that you want to make, but you should be very conscious that you're making it, that you're opening the door to numerous persons that have never had any contact with the criminal system, never really realize that they're engaging in conduct that might be construed as a crime, to being at least indicted and subjected to a trial. Now, on this point, when we look at a conspiracy statute, it appears to be fairly reasonable in the sense that it requires an overt act. Well, the case law that has evolved, at least in the federal system, on what an overt act is, I've tried cases in which there's been instructions given and upheld on appeal that read basically to the effect that an overt act can be very minor. It may be as much as walking across the street. This is the language out of the instructions. Making a telephone call. Attending a meeting. And I think in the recent conspiracy case, for instance, in federal court, I wasn't directly involved in it, but the McVeigh case, Mr. Eric, I believe, the real estate gentleman that was eventually acquitted, had to go through an entire trial simply because he attended one meeting at which there was some discussion about leasing a facility in Valdez, and then suddenly he was in the federal court on an indictment for conspiracy. So I submit that the decision to introduce into the jurisprudence of Alaska a conspiracy statute is a major one, and something that should not be taken lightly and should have some underlying real necessity before you do it. The other real problem with a conspiracy statute, other than the fact that you can get indicted very easily, is that you can also get convicted very easily. Specifically, the Ninth Circuit and the Seventh Circuit, being the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which has jurisdiction over Alaska, and the Seventh Circuit, which has jurisdiction over Illinois and the Midwestern states, have repeatedly affirmed convictions and held that once a conspiracy is established, that slight evidence or very little evidence is sufficient to connect a particular defendant. Now, for years, they used to even instruct, in some circuits, they still do instruct the jury in that language. That is, that once a conspiracy is established, that is, if defendant A is definitely proven to conspire with defendant B, then very little or slight evidence is sufficient to connect defendant C. And, of course, if you're going to be talking about extortion or fraud or business crimes, I think you can see the potential for abuse. And just one final thing in this area is the evidentiary problems are extreme. Specifically, you're often in a situation in which you're in court with numerous defendants. There will be alleged statements made by a co-defendant, and you can't get cross-examination. As you know, of course, cross-examination and confrontation are a basic constitutional right under both the Alaska and U.S. constitutions. In the words of Wigmore, who's a renowned authority on evidence, cross-examination is the greatest legal engine yet devised for the ascertainment of the truth. In conspiracy trials, it's usually non-existent, because the common technique a prosecutor will follow is to try and get statements in, and will get them in, from a co-defendant that allegedly implicate another co-defendant, and then that first co-defendant won't take the stand, will plead his Fifth Amendment privileges, and you can never cross-examine the person as to what he meant. Did he really say it? Was he drunk when he said it? Did he know what he was talking about? And of course, you're left with a jury that's been instructed on the slight evidence instructions. So I submit that unless there's some strong necessity, and I have never heard it advanced yet, that can't be covered under other statutes, that it's a very dangerous thing to bring a conspiracy statute to Alaska.
I have one question. You were talking about the application of those two business crimes to the conspiracy statute. And we now have conspiracy to commit kidnapping under existing law. So we have added, I believe, murder and the arson. Mm-hmm. And I believe that the committee has expressed some desire perhaps to expand that to perhaps include sexual penetration without consent, rape, and robbery. If it was limited to specific person crimes, so serious person crimes, would you still be generally opposed to that?
Yes, because I think I don't understand. I mean, I can understand why a prosecutor would want the statute, because it makes his job a lot, in his view, a lot easier. But I don't understand, if you really want to try and reach some kind of conduct, why it's necessary to have a conspiracy statute. On the kidnapping, for instance, I'm not totally familiar with how this code is going to treat the problem of child stealing, or not child stealing, but parents that are fighting over children and
we exclude that from the coverage of kidnapping.
Of course, that's present, and if you pass a conspiracy statute for kidnapping and there's a later amendment to include it, as they're doing in other states, you're in a situation that if a mother comes to an attorney's office and he gives her advice to go snatch a child, maybe even good faith advice under a court order, you can get indicted for for conspiracy to kidnap. The point is that conspiracy itself, by definition, is merely a crime of speech. It's a crime that is easy to allege, it's hard to disprove, it has connotations or with jurors and with the public that tend to make it hard to get a fair trial. The rules of evidence are such that it's very hard to get a fair trial, and I submit it definitely has a chilling effect on free speech. And unless, now the reasons that have historically been advanced for conspiracy statutes are that somehow it's necessary to get the kingpins because they send their underlings out to do these crimes, and you've got to get. And I submit that that's just mainly a straw man analysis. But in direct response to your question, yes, I certainly would still oppose it.
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chairman, even though your answer was generally yes, you would still oppose the conspiracy statute, if you don't mind my using this glorious technique of cross-examination that you quoted Professor Wigmore as to.
Certainly.
Isn't it true that most of your examples of horribles addressed the inclusion of offenses other than offenses against the person in the conspiracy statute?
Well, I can give you a good example on murder. Since it's simply a pure speech crime and an overt act is sufficient and talk is cheap, as they say, it's a fact of life that people sometimes talk about killing other people when they don't mean
it. First of all, the responsive answer to my question was yes, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. And now I'd like an opportunity
just
to explain my answer.
Professor Wigmore. Okay.
Certainly, right. And I'd like an opportunity to explain my answer. So, in terms of murder, for instance, it's a fact of life that people often talk about killing other people when bar talk, if you will, or they're angry and they say, I really wish someone was dead, or let's do away with so and so. And in reality, they may never possess the capacity to even get near to really doing it. But since an overt act can be as simple, as they say in the instruction, as crossing a street to go talk to another person about it, making a phone call to find out where the person is, that's conspiracy to commit murder. And there may be reasons for punishing an attempt, but I submit that you're pretty far afield when you're going to punish pure speech on a simple overt act concept. There's a recent case in Fairbanks where a person was actually convicted of an attempt on the attempt to commit murder. I think, in fact, Mr. Rubenstein, who was here before, was his defense counsel prior to becoming on the judicial council.
His clients kept getting convicted, so they got another job. So that.
Well, maybe, but what I'm saying is that these abuses do appear across the board. They're more grievous as you get into the less violent crimes, I think.
Mr. Chairman, I would suggest that most of the abuses and horrible results that he's describing could be addressed if we were to include only offenses against the person, and if we would make it clear from our definition that we are not incorporating by reference the too light definition of overt act, which is allowed under the federal jurisdiction.
That was discussed at the subcommission's level, and one of the suggestions was to require that it be a substantial overt act, you know, because overt act, what does overt act means? I agree with Phil, that's it's walking across the street. Well, when you talk about substantial overt act, you're probably talking about a substantial step, which is sufficient for an attempt. So if you're going to decide you want something more than what's commonly been thought of as an overt act, well, you don't need a conspiracy statute.
Was it the intention of the subcommission, or was this done consciously, that to include by reference or by implication the federal case law that he referred to with this very light
Well, I believe that is correct. I think I referred to very, you know, very briefly in the commentary that we don't define overt act. The term has been defined significantly in other decisions.
So you are incorporating the general case law.
And based on my reading of those decisions, anything is just about an overt act. So.
I think that was, if I might point out the response he made, that
If you want more than a substantial overt act, you don't need a conspiracy statute. It's covered by attempt, and that's what I've been trying to say, is that I don't think you need a conspiracy statute unless you want to... If you want to convict people that are make some loose talk, aren't really careful with their words, and when someone else goes out and does a minor act, then you should have a conspiracy statute. But if you just want to convict people that are guilty of what I consider real criminal conduct, then I think that most people may know the real facts would, then I submit you don't need a conspiracy statute. It's a popular statute because it gives the prosecutors wide latitude. Personally, I've talked to two trial judges, old-time trial judges, hard-line trial judges, hard-sentencing trial judges that are definitely against presumptive sentencing and feel that it's a real mistake to try and tie their hands. I've also talked to at least two old-time, hard-line, hard-sentencing trial judges, Ralph Moody being one of them, who thinks it's a real mistake to give us, being the defense bar, a shot at all these statutes and to totally rewrite every statute. I think he ought to realize that.
He testified to that extent last year.
He did. Okay.
He thinks we ought to maintain a code written for the 1928.
Well, the point is, I would urge you to try and at least have one or two trial judges. I don't know if they'll come and testify, and maybe they won't. They may feel that they're under the same constraints as Mr. Snowden indicated, but I think you should at least contact them. The other thing is I've been speaking to a number of private attorneys in Anchorage that would still like some input into this. If there's any possible way, I would urge you to conduct hearings in Anchorage. I don't know if it's feasible or not, but specifically I know Gail Frades was very interested in this murder bill. And I know there are people from Blyko's firm and Wendell Kay's firm are very interested. And if there's any possible way, I'd urge you to either invite written comments or have hearings in Anchorage.
And maybe practicing law at Juneau, when we talked about the murder statute under the tentative draft last year, now that we're considering the bill, he's practicing law in Anchorage and he wants to take the committee to Anchorage so he can testify before the committee. After the subcommittee also considered it in hearings in Anchorage.
Well, I don't know, members of the bar, there are a lot of financial and other constraints.
Yes, I've noticed that.
You should know that. We appreciate your suggestion about the hearing, and we'll have a hearing in Anchorage if there's actually people who want to testify.
So thank you very much, General, for your time.
Sam Letterman, I got that right.
Chairman, if I disappear, it's because it's 3:30, I've got a legislative council meeting.
I think it's more important.
Wait till 3:30.
How do you think you get that going off at 3:30?
My name is Seema Letterman. I'm director of the Community Crime Prevention Program, and I'm here today representing my program, the Criminal Justice Planning Agency, as well as the views of the Attorney General. I'd like to start off by saying that I strongly believe that we do need a comprehensive criminal code, and that the sections I'm going to be talking about are those relating to...
Could you speak up? Can I hear you very
well? The sections I'm going to be talking about are those relating to sexual assault, and in general, I support those sections. Now, I have one specific objection, though, and that is subsection B in the general provisions of Article 4, which states that a person does not commit... No, I don't.
It's 1141, probably 400.
Sounds like something.
Page 52, 1141, 400, A, I'm sorry, B.
52.
Line 17.
Okay, thanks.
Subsection B states that a person does not commit the crime of sexual assault in any degree if the victim is his legal spouse, unless the spouses are living apart and one of them has filed for divorce. When I decided to come here to testify today from Anchorage, I was about a week ago, and I started taking an informal poll of all the people whom I met in the course of my work, when I went to the Quick Stop, my child's babysitter, everybody I came in contact with, and asked them what they thought about this, if this should be deleted or if this should be kept in the proposed criminal code. I found something very strange. Almost all the attorneys I talked to support this subsection staying in the code. And every single one of the non-attorneys whom I talked to thought that this should be taken out, with one exception, who was a retired state trooper who said 9 out of 10 rape reports are false anyway, and it's all women's lib nonsense, and so on. The attorneys that I talked to did have some serious objections, though, and I'd like to address those here. The almost across-the-board immediate response of the attorneys who did not agree in deleting this subsection said, why not call it an assault? If a man rapes his wife or takes her by force, why not just call it assault and not get into the whole rape problem? I contend that prosecutors will still have that option if this subsection is removed. But by removing spousal immunity, it gives the prosecution that option, and those most heinous of cases, the most horrific kinds of circumstances, where a man actually rapes his wife, or a wife actually rapes her husband. I guess that's now allowed.
They're allowed to, people admit it exists. The big long lecture from Professor Wexler that no such rape was possible, you know, a lot of the women in the class disagree.
I'm looking forward to the first case of that. I'd like to suggest a couple of examples where this legislation would apply. A woman who's just had a hysterectomy or a serious operation and has been advised by her doctor that she must not have sex, and her husband forces it on her. A woman who's having a problem pregnancy, and her husband forces her to have sex with him. Or the example of a woman who may have left her husband, and he comes over to her house and sexually assaults both her and her child, son or daughter. In that circumstance, her assault would be an assault, a simple assault, and the child's assault would be a sexual assault. And that seems a very unfair kind of discrimination to me. The second objection that most attorneys have is that there'd be a serious proof problem in the case of rape or sexual assault between married people. I think that's a serious problem. And it would be especially difficult as the proposed code eliminates resistance as a necessary part of proving rape. Right now, all rapes go through very vigorous screening and investigative processes before they go to court. And I'm quite sure that even more vigorous examination and screening would occur in cases of spousal assault. In fact, I would almost be afraid that the screening processes would eliminate cases where an actual rape did occur and where the person really does deserve prosecution. But I think that it would just about eliminate the fear that scores of devoted husbands would be tried for raping their wives because they were a little amorous that night and she was a little bit grumpy. The third objection was that this would certainly increase the number of false reports for rape. As a consultant to the Criminal Justice Center at the University of Alaska, I went through the Anchorage Police Department files, case by case, for 1975 and 1976, in rape as well as other crimes. The Criminal Justice Plan, 1978 crime in Alaska, cites unfounded rapes to be 17% of reported forcible rapes, and that this was four times the 4% unfounded rape for all Part 1 offenses. Well, as I was going through these cases, case by case, I found that the most common reasons for designating a rape report as unfounded were that the victim had been drinking, that the facts were unclear or confused or contradictory, that the victim didn't seem upset enough, that there was some lapse of time between the report and the offense, that the suspect was the victim's husband, that the victim was hitchhiking, that the victim was a prostitute, that the suspect was a cab driver, that the victim may have known the suspect for some time, or that the victim admitted that it was a false report. In those reports for 1975 and 76, there were only two cases where the victims admitted they were false reports. One was an adolescent who was trying to escape problems with her mother for being out all night, and the other was a very drunk woman who had fallen down behind a bar. I believe that the very high unfounded rate for rapes is based largely on expectations. Susan Brownmiller, who's probably done the most definitive study on rape to date, reports that the unfounded rape rate in New York City dropped dramatically after the police department began assigning police women to investigate rape cases. As a person who's been raped myself, and has gone through the police investigation process, I have to say that a person would have to have some psychotic tendency towards masochism to expose herself to the inconvenience, to the time, and to the embarrassment and humiliation of a police investigation for rape, if there were not some true basis for it. And I think that would go be even more true in cases of spousal rape. If so few cases can be proven, and if even fewer prosecuted, why have a law that's not enforced? That was another one of the objections, that we have enough laws on our books that aren't enforced now, and we don't need another one. Well, I think that law sometimes should be simply a statement of what we as a society accept or don't accept in given behavior, what we find abhorrent or what we find morally right. The history of rape legislation, police attitudes, prosecutors' reluctance to take a rape case to court, judges' handling of rape cases, and juries' reluctance to convict is the history of a society which has said, in effect, rape is all right. We're seeing a change in that attitude. Indeed, the revised criminal code is one giant step in that direction, to change that attitude and to say we do not believe that rape is something that's all right. But we need to go a little bit farther. We need to declare that rape under any circumstance is abhorrent to our society. When we have a law that says that it will be the responsibility, when we have a law that says that we do not accept rape under any circumstances, it will be the responsibility of those who execute the law to see that it's enforced, and the responsibility of citizens to make sure that those public servants carry out their responsibility. Another objection was, what good will it do? What good will it do to have a law like that?
These comments are still on the subsection B.
All of them, yes. As director of the Community Crime Prevention Program, which is a statewide program funded by LEAA and is in the governor's office, I'm naturally very concerned about the preventative aspects of any law, and especially rape, since the state of Alaska has the highest rate of rape in the United States. Simply having rape laws on the books obviously has not stopped rape in our communities. And of course, there are many explanations regarding the unique Alaskan experience which may or may not explain that. Again, legislation must be followed by vigorous commitment by all segments of the criminal justice system to do what it takes to enforce the law. And this must be coupled with intense public education to finally dissolve those myths surrounding rape which blame the victim. Each community needs to provide services and advocacy for victims of intrafamily violence the result of which will be less reluctance on the part of victims to report the crime and a firmer resolve on the part of victims to pursue prosecution. All this, of course, is true of sexual assault in general, but it includes spousal rape. I have difficulty understanding why criminal behavior between married people is really different than criminal behavior between people who may know each other but are not married, or even between strangers. Probably the most challenging response of the attorneys I talked to was that by permitting a wife to report a sexual assault by her husband or vice versa, the institution of marriage in a general sense and individual marital relationships would be severely threatened or weakened. To begin with, the institution of marriage isn't doing so well right now. I think that the latest figures are that one out of two marriages end in divorce. Maybe it's not that they're not doing so well or marriage is suffering, but I think marriage is going through a period of very difficult transition. One of the reasons for that is that as more and more opportunities open up for women, and as women take more and more responsibility for their own support and for the support of their families, we women are much less likely to bear the unbearable in the way that our mothers did. There's been so much popular literature on the changing expectations of marriage that I don't think I could tell you anything here today that you don't already know. Suffice it to say that many men and most women no longer believe that sexual gratification is a male's prerogative in marriage. When I entered into the marriage contract, I did agree that this was the man with whom I would have a sexual relationship. But that agreement meant that my husband and I would have sex when both of us wanted it. That agreement apparently is a super legal one, because under the law and in the new criminal code, spousal immunity declares that only one of us needs to want to have sex at any given time, and the other person must provide it. Rather than weakening the marriage contract, removing spousal immunity would in fact strengthen it. I think by removing it, it would remove one of the most outmoded concepts of what marriage consists of. Removing spousal immunity would in fact simply officially confirm what most people today believe and practice, that getting married does not deprive me of my right to say no to sex when I don't want to have sex. I have enough faith in people in general not to expect that as soon as spousal immunity is deleted, there will be hundreds of wives rushing to the police department and to the state troopers reporting that their husband raped them. There may certainly be some cases like this, and there may be some unfounded cases. A minor problem. I think Alaska has such a tremendous opportunity to lead the rest of the nation in adopting a criminal code which affords equal protection of the law to married people. If, however, the objections that I've just mentioned seem to you stronger than my very persuasive arguments, I think that short of deleting spousal immunity altogether, you still have an opportunity to make the law of Alaska regarding sexual assault the most progressive and the most humane. The subsection modifies the exclusion of conjugal intercourse from the prohibition of rape where two provable events have occurred. The couple is living apart and one of them has filed for divorce. I submit that the cause of justice would be greatly served if the exclusion were modified to read, a person does not commit the crime of sexual assault if the victim is his or her legal spouse, unless the spouses are living apart. And the Attorney General in particular supports this. When a married couple separates, I think it's very rare for them to immediately, or one of them, to immediately run out and file for divorce. That's a traumatic period, a period of doubts and insecurities, and oftentimes a period when there's a great deal of hope that the marriage can be put back together. There may be circumstances where one of the couple intends to file for divorce, and there's a lapse of time before she can reach a lawyer. or a lapse of time between seeing an attorney and filing for a divorce. During this period, at the very least, if not throughout the marriage, the provisions of the law protecting people from sexual assault should be extended. As I was going through the police files and looking at the various circumstances of people's lives involved in various crimes, this particular period is probably one of the most violent in people's lives. I'd like to reiterate my support for the proposed sexual assault legislation and compliment the framers on recognizing the need for a more reasonable approach to the problem of rape in our state. I thank you.
Questions from Mr. Dankwood?
Well, I don't know why we should probably even get into this, but there's some real questions arise there, like in yours. When you look through police files, and they say that they didn't prosecute a rape case because the lady was a cab driver or because she was drunk, I couldn't help but think that probably all those police reports would reflect in an investigation the occupation of the person, or that they were enumerated, or that they knew the person and all that. The file that would have been important, I think, is the one in the district attorney's office, because that policeman doesn't decide whether to prosecute or not. But I couldn't imagine a district attorney turning down a rape case because the lady was a cab driver.
The case that I was talking about was not where the woman was a cab driver, but where the offender was a cab driver. And the question of doubt arose because there may have been a motive for the woman to say rape and therefore not have to pay her cab fare.
But was it presented to the district attorney's office? That was the only question that I make. Sometimes I think it's important, because I personally didn't know of any serious rape case that was reported or lady claim rape that wasn't, the final determination was made by the district attorney's office.
Now, talking about whether or not the district attorney accepts the case for prosecution. I think there were only 11 cases which went to court last year. I'm talking about whether they're classified as an unfounded report.
Anyway, we've dwelled on that long enough. I always thought that when you got married, you somehow, at the time you married, you I believe you used the word, you agreed to sexual whatever to you with your husband. However, you didn't agree that only one could decide when to do it.
That's right.
I agree with that. I think that's a very true statement. But since when we get into consent or not consent to sex, I think we're getting in the terms of rape, unless you've already, by marrying someone, consented to it. But it would seem at that point that you don't have to. I've never thought that my wife had to consent any time I wanted to. And if I forced her, she has a criminal charge against me for assault against her. And those laws we have now, I don't think you can force anybody to do anything. It would seem to me that would be assault, but I couldn't see the, I don't know, and you know, there's a practical thing, I think any attorney can tell you, you've got a chance of going in and convincing the jury, you know, that this wasn't a result of an argument. Since I think rape is such an important crime, and I've testified to this before, it should be kept at the top of one of our most serious offenses in this state, and to protect people from that crime, that we don't want to put it in a category where we get it mixed up into marital arguments and problems, and you're going to end up in court with every wife that gets mad at her husband or something. You're going to see a great many of those run in often enough to where juries are going to say, here comes another family beef, and she's claiming rape, and I'm afraid that pretty soon everybody will begin to look at this less serious than if...